All right, so big question, who is the giver of life? And as we get into these two miracle questions, or just these miracle stories, I wanted to talk about the difference between magic and miracle. So what do you guys think? What's the difference between magic and miracle? Is there a difference? Yeah.
Yeah. One's deception mm-hmm. and one's reality.
Okay. One's deception, one's reality. I like that. Anything else? What's the difference between magic and miracle?
Maybe there's not much meaning behind magic.
Yeah, possibly so. Magic shows up a lot in the Bible, in both in the Old Testament and the New Testament. In Acts, it shows up 3 times. With people who are claiming to be sorcerers and this kind of thing. So there's some kind of power there that keeps people coming back. The question is, where are they getting that power from? So I think for me, magic is about using an existing force in creation to change that same old creation, right? So when we see the magicians in the story of Moses replicating some of the signs and that kind of thing, they're using some kind of power they have access to, whether or not it's just straight up trickery or some kind of supernatural something is happening. I wasn't there, I don't know. But there's something that at least the people around them believe is powerful. In Acts, we have one of my favorite stories is the sons of Sceva who are trying to cast out demons in the name of Jesus, and the demon looks at them and says, I don't know who you are. I know Paul and I know Jesus. I don't know you. And beats them so badly they flee the house naked. Like, how bad do you have to be beaten up that you'll lose all your clothes? And then the end of that story is they repent and they gather up all their magic scrolls to be destroyed. And it says those were worth 50,000 drachma. That's a drachma is a day's wages. So that's 135 years worth of work in magic scrolls. And they're like, okay, we obviously do not have power in these scrolls. All right, so miracle or sign, I think, is about new creation breaking through the old creation. Specifically in John, and really in the Gospels in general, but John does it very intentionally. It's this kind of leaking through of God's universe, God's dimension, into our own as a foretaste of what it will be like when God recreates all of heaven and earth and fixes everything that's been broken on the old earth. And the difference between a miracle and a miracle is this using power, supernatural power, to accomplish something, but it's not necessarily specifically to point the people in a direction. In John, the signs are. When he calls something a sign, it is specifically because Jesus is doing something very much on purpose to point in the direction of the new kingdom that is coming. So, miracle, sign. Any questions, comments on this? Good? All right, cool. And just as an example, a miracle would be like Jesus walking on water because he had to get to the other side, like... That's what the text says is like he wasn't intending for the disciples to see him. He just needed to get across the water and was like, well, let's go. All right. Okay. So the first story we're going to cover is the royal official's son. So what kind of royal official? It just says royal official. The word used there could mean family member of a king. It could, but it's probably someone who works in the royal household. If he's coming from Capernaum, he is probably coming from the court of Herod Antipas. That is, the coin there is one of that particular Herod's coins. So he is from associated with the Hasmoneans. The Hasmoneans are client kings of Rome. They're Jewish-ish. They have some connection to Judaism. They're not necessarily... entirely faithful or practicing, but they are enough Jewish that they count. They have intermarried with other powerful people in the region. So they technically, Herod Antipas is in charge of Galilee. He is in charge of it as long as everything is running smoothly. When it stops running smoothly, Rome will absolutely come in. There aren't Roman soldiers like hanging out on street corners unless there's a specific like threat of violence. They're mostly up in the Syrian territory, and then there is some in Jerusalem. So he probably works in the household of Herod. He comes to Jesus and says, "I need you to come with me to heal my son." This is the first healing miracle in John. So how does he know Jesus can heal his son? The official scholarly answer is, like there's a reference in chapter 2 that he did some miracles in Jerusalem around the Passover. It doesn't tell us exactly what. He might have done some healings there. We don't know why this guy came from Capernaum. It's not a huge distance, but it's a day's walk. So he came from Capernaum to get Jesus to come back to Capernaum to heal his son. So he says, "Please come with me. You have to, if this is going to work, you have to come with me to where my son is." All the way back in Capernaum, they're in Cana at this point. And Jesus says to him, "Unless you people see signs and wonders, you will never believe." Well, this sounds a little harsh, right? I mean, this guy is coming to him saying, "My son is dying, please help me." And he says, "Unless you people see signs and wonders." But is it all that harsh, really? Because what we're talking about in this whole chunk is, what is the purpose of the signs? If you get so hung up on the signs that you miss the big picture. All right, so the danger is that people get so focused on the signs that they miss what the signs are pointing to. N.T. Wright has a great example of, it's as if a city chooses to solve its traffic congestion problems by making these really beautiful street signs, and they commission artists, and they're like, "Yes, these are going to be the best, most clearly communicated street signs ever," and it just makes the traffic worse because everybody's taking pictures of the street signs, right? So that's kind of the danger here, is that they're so focused on the signs that they miss what the signs are pointing to. The man doesn't stop asking. In fact, the Greek here is, he keeps asking. He persists. And this time he changes his language a little bit. He says, "If you don't come, my little boy will die." It changes the word from son to little boy. So this is a small child who has a fever and is on the edge of death. And so Jesus says to him, "Your son will live." And what would you do in that situation? You've been begging this guy that you think might be able to help, and he says, "Okay, your son will live." What's your next step? Yeah.
I think I've come all this way. I've sacrificed my dying moments for my little lad here.
Yeah.
I didn't come so you would say that. I came. You're coming with me.
Yeah. You would try to do whatever you can to make him come with you. Yeah. I'm with you. Anybody else?
We need to hope if he actually trusted that he was for real and mm-hmm. legit, that if he says something like that, it's true.
Yeah. And that's, go ahead.
I was just wondering how far, because I don't know the mm-hmm. area that well, how far was Cana and the wedding from this area?
Same town. So
he would have possibly heard about the big wedding.
Right. He could have heard of that miracle. Okay. How he made the jump from water to wine
to healing, sure.
You know, okay. It's not out of the way. Good question. Capernaum is about a day's walk. But what it says is the man takes him at his word. He believes him. He believes my son will live. And in fact, he stays in town because Capernaum is a day's walk away. So the next part says, and the next day, as he's going to back home, he meets people and they say, "Your son is healed." He says, when did his fever break? When did he get better? And the answer is at exactly the same time that you were talking to Jesus. So this royal official and his household believe in Jesus. So, and that's kind of the way it worked in the ancient world, is that it wasn't individual belief as much as who you were related to, like genetically was very important. Who you're related to socially is very important. So there's lots of places, especially in Acts, where it says, and the whole household believed. So all of his household now believes, which is interesting because he's working in the court of Herod Antipas. This is the guy who has John the Baptist killed. And so now there's a guy on the inside who believes in Jesus in the court. All right. So.
Doesn't Jesus call Herod the fox?
Yes.
Or is that a different Herod?
I think, well, I mean, here's the problem. Herod the Great has three sons who are all named Herod. Very creative. So, yes, he's referring to this dynasty. Yeah.
The bunch.
A lot of them. All right. So this is a key contrast, I think, that this man takes him at his word. Versus, unless you see signs, you will never believe. Because if you look in the text, it's kind of interesting. It says he goes to Galilee, and a prophet has no honor in his hometown, and they welcome him. But you just said he has no honor, so what? I think the signs go in. Yeah, go ahead.
I think that's John's commentary. Mm-hmm. John's saying, the synoptics all tell you that a prophet has no, but let me tell you about that.
Yeah, yeah.
He's changing it.
Maybe so. He's putting his own spin on it. That works. All right. Unless you see signs, you will never believe. All right. So, moving on to our next miracle. Jesus then goes to Jerusalem. It says he goes for a festival. It doesn't tell us which one. Sometimes the festivals he's going to are directly related to whatever he's going to do in Jerusalem. He's kind of retelling whatever story they're celebrating in that festival, like the Passover. So, he goes to the sheep gate, and there is a pool here. This is probably a mikveh, which is a ceremonial cleansing pool. In order to go into the temple, you have to be clean. And in order to be clean, you need to wash with living water, water that has not been stale, water that is from a stream or a spring. So, interestingly, there has been a lot of archaeology that has confirmed this account here, that there was a mikvah in this location. It did have five porches. They're counting them as 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So there are steps that go down into the water where people would wash. This taller one is directly fed by springs and streams. And the way that you make unclean water clean is that you add living water. So periodically, the living water from here, they would open up a little thing, and it would flow down to the bottom one. So there's a man who's been there for we don't know how long. He has been paralyzed for 38 years. When the average lifespan in this era is not a lot more than 38 years, he's been here for a long time. So, Jesus walks up to him and says, do you want to get well? And he answers in a, yeah, like, I don't know, I hear a duh in here. Why else would I be here if I didn't want to get well? But the rumor is that when the water moves, it means an angel is stirring the water, and whoever is first in the pool will be healed, but he doesn't have anyone to put him in the pool, right? The angel comment is interesting. It's not in the earliest copies that we have of John. It may have been their explanation for them opening the sluice and letting water come in, and that's why it's bubbling up, which is another, that's the living water. That's the freshest of cleansing water. So maybe that's why they associated that with the healing. So, do you want to get well? The man says yes. And Jesus says, okay, well then get up. Pick up your mat and walk. It's interesting here, all of the superstition around this site, and it had been for centuries before this and centuries after, associated with healing. Jesus doesn't do anything with the water. Doesn't like grab a little bit of the water, nothing. He just tells him to get up. It's just a word, and he gets up. And just like in the same story with the official son, it's just a word. And I think John is emphasizing the power that Jesus has here. Because even in the Old Testament stories of healing, usually you had to with, you know, Elijah and Elisha. They would lay their hands on them and that kind of thing to heal. But Jesus can talk from miles away and the healing happens. The same thing at the pool. He just says, get up, and the healing happens.
Reminiscent of God speaking and creation happening.
Yeah.
There's power in just the words.
Absolutely. As God spoke creation, spoke order into creation with his words, then the word made flesh is doing the same thing of bringing order to the chaos that is all around. All right, so this man has been here for 38 years. And Jesus chooses this particular day to come in and heal him. I absolutely think this is on purpose. He could have done it the day before. He could have done it the day after. He knows it's the Sabbath. I think he is doing this healing on the Sabbath on purpose. There are, I think, 7 times across the Gospels where Jesus does healings on the Sabbath to prove this point. The man is seen carrying his mat. This is technically work. There probably at the time of Jesus, it was written down a little bit later and codified a little bit later, but there are all sorts of extra rules about how to keep the Torah. One of them was about Sabbath. There were like 39 different types of work that you can't do on the Sabbath. Carrying things, carrying a burden is one of them, so he is breaking the Sabbath. I enjoy the interchange here between the healed man and the officials who are calling him down. You know, you're breaking the Sabbath. And he's like, the guy who healed me told me to. And they're like, well, that's an even bigger deal. Who healed you? I don't know. yeah. It's funny. And I think there's some parts of it that are supposed to be funny that we may miss sometimes because the text is sacred and the text is solemn and it also is funny. And there, especially in the Old Testament, there are like, you know, literal, we would consider them slightly off-color jokes, about poop and things like that. Like it's in the text. So there are parts that are supposed to be funny. You're breaking the Sabbath.
They don't preach well.
Yeah. Yeah, my joke is always the Old Testament is extremely R-rated. Why are we teaching it to children? we sanitize a little bit and they get to middle school and go, oh my gosh, that's in there? Or high college even. All right. So he says, I don't know who heals me. Later, Jesus sees him in the temple and says, you're well. Don't sin again so that something worse may not happen to you. And this is one of the kind of tricky bits where sin and disease are related somehow. Like in 9, we have Jesus saying it's not the blind man's fault. It's not his sin. It's not his parents' sin that he's blind. But here, what's going on with Jesus telling this man to sin no more so that something worse doesn't happen to you? We don't know. The text doesn't say if he had some sort of supernatural insight, if this man's paralysis was the result of some kind of sin. We don't know. Text doesn't say. But Jesus takes the time to say that to him. So now he knows, the man who is healed knows who has healed him, and he goes to tell the authorities. Is this snitching or is this, glorifying? No, this is the guy who healed me. Again, text doesn't say what his motivations were. There are different opinions on which one it was. But now the authorities know. It was Jesus who commanded this man who healed on the Sabbath, and who commanded this man to pick up his mat. So, this is a really big deal to break the Sabbath, partly because, especially the Pharisaical element of around Jerusalem at this time, they are very, very focused on keeping the laws as strictly as possible. Because if you keep the laws, that limits how many times you have to go to the temple and make sacrifices, because that's expensive. And also, the temple is pretty corrupt. The temple is run by a lot of people who are in league with the Hasmoneans and the Romans and all of that kind of thing. So the Pharisees are kind of an anti-temple movement. They're not going to forbid you from going to the temple, but they're going to try to go there as little as possible. To follow the law as hard as they can. So Sabbath is one of the things that is distinctive for the Jews, that they don't work on the seventh day. This is just a work day for everyone else in the ancient world. So it's a way that they could keep the laws in the Holy Land. It's a way they could keep the laws when they were in exile. This is a very core part of their identity, is we are the ones who keep the Sabbath, all right? So, after this, this becomes a Law and Order episode. anybody hear the noise? The dun, dun. because it starts using legal terms. It says that the authorities start persecuting Jesus. And the word there is found in legal documents for, like, the prosecution. So the crime is he has broken the Sabbath. He has done a healing on the Sabbath. He has commanded someone else to break the Sabbath. And then they decide to prosecute him. And in their decision, Jesus is answering them. And they say, "You broke the Sabbath." And he goes, "Yeah, I did. God still works on the Sabbath." And this was a part of the Jewish understanding that God doesn't stop being God on the Sabbath, from sundown on Friday to sundown on Saturday, right? Like, the world keeps spinning, babies are born, people die. That still happens on the Sabbath. So God is still working on the Sabbath. He gets a pass because he's God. But then Jesus says, "Because I am the Son of God, I can work on the Sabbath too." And that leads to the second charge against him, which is claiming to be God, right? So they're real mad at this point. This is a beginning. It's interesting, like, in the other Gospels we have Jesus avoiding Jerusalem, and really it's just kind of like, from the healing of Lazarus on, we get the more contentious, and they're going to kill him, and they're trying to kill him, and they're trying to kill him. From John, it's basically from here on. They're trying to kill him. And because of his... he broke the Sabbath, but the way the Greek is worded there, it could be he keeps doing things like this. It's not a one-time action word. It's an ongoing word. So he keeps doing things like this. And then, to justify his work, he is claiming to be divine, right? All right, questions?
Well,
yeah.
Or maybe more comment.
Go ahead.
Or question if this is talked about in this, that there was already an existing, my understanding is there's already an existing hierarchy of laws, and mm-hmm. some laws trump others, you know, the whole thing of, like, helping a donkey out of a ditch,
right,
or whatever. And so doing something helpful mm-hmm. could be considered not a problem. It's breaking Sabbath, but it's not breaking the law, and that, yeah, because this trumps that.
Yeah, there was a hierarchy. There was an ability to, if you could argue it, if you had the status to argue it, if you had the knowledge to argue it, you could. And there's an element of, if it's an emergency, you can help. But I think what the authorities in Jerusalem would say is this was not an emergency. This guy had been paralyzed for 38 years. Nothing was changing about today in their mind. So that's the break in the Sabbath part of it. Yeah.
So... In Mishnah Torah, there's 39 rules.
Right.
And those rules have the reason is that the Pharisees are trying to be holier than anyone else. There's a law that says if you wake up in the morning, you need to think about what day it is, because if it's the Sabbath, you can't turn over in bed.
Right.
Or you've broken
right.
the Sabbath. If you go to Israel today, there are Shabbat elevators. Mm-hmm. Have you heard of those?
No.
So there's like an elevator on the right, an elevator on the left. There's an elevator for Shabbat that you don't have to reach up and touch.
You have to push the button.
Right. It goes to a floor, it opens. It
yeah.
goes to the next floor, it opens. And that's what you take in Shabbat. Mm-hmm. Because anything else would be work. They're trying to be holier
right.
than everyone else.
Right. And part of what the Pharisaic drive to be holy is they recognize that Israel has lost its status and lost its power. And if we can just keep the law closely enough, maybe God will bless us again. Maybe he'll send the Messiah. Maybe we'll have a second David. Maybe if we can just keep the law, if we can just get enough people to keep it so carefully, we can bring it, usher in this new age. So that's their idea of how the new age is going to come, is we are going to keep the law so well that God will recognize our righteousness and send the Messiah.
I just think it's important to defend the Pharisees a little bit because yeah. those are us.
Yeah. Oh, yes. That's my brothers and sisters in the churches of Christ, we are the Pharisees. Okay? Absolutely.
We have good intentions. We try.
Yes. We try. We try and we miss. Because, again, in the text, the Pharisees are the bad guys a lot. But they were kind of the champion of the little guy. So you didn't have to be associated with the temple. You didn't have to be associated with Rome. They were kind of seen as more populist than a lot of the other teachers. So, yeah.
You know, my basic thoughts is how this legalistic mindset has interwoven itself into our social fabric of being, even into politics, and how some states are so legalistic in looking at the Old Testament. So Jesus, to me, is woke, pardon the expression.
Yeah.
And he's taken the old and said, you ain't got to do that.
Mm-hmm.
This is a new age, and it's like cracking a walnut and getting the good, all the good out of it. And so I'm so thankful for his life.
Absolutely,
he's helping us see a lot.
Yeah, and that's part of why he was dangerous. Part of because he is pointing to this future kingdom. And the people who have power in this kingdom probably aren't going to have power in the future kingdom. And so there's a tension there for the people in charge. And so that's why some people react to him with relief almost, and some people react to him with fear because he's, what are you talking about? Because he's basically in this passage being like, this Sabbath isn't the important thing anymore. And they're like, for hundreds of years it has been. So who are you that you get to come in and tell us not? Yeah.
I think also in Churches of Christ, since that's what I'm most familiar with, I think a lot of people misread these kind of passages to think that Jesus was abolishing the Sabbath. And I don't think that's the case at all.
Right.
But it's like, oh, Jesus didn't do it, so let's not bother with the Sabbath. Where the Sabbath... It was a good thing, is a good thing, is meant for our well-being, and it still has a lot of value, but we just have taken it as a free pass to never do it.
Yeah, and that's the tension of, because he says, I didn't come to abolish the law, right? But he is pointing out places like this where they've taken it too far of you won't even allow a healing on the Sabbath. But yeah, the concept of Sabbath, of resting in God's goodness, that's good. We should do that more. We should not be so wrapped up in our own agency that, you know, all the plates will stop spinning if I take a day off and come crashing to the ground. That's a good point. That's finding that balance between I didn't come to abolish the law, but also let's not be so legalistic about all the things. All right. So, the next part is Jesus goes to trial. Next part of our Law and Order episode here. So, Jesus starts defending himself, his crimes, if you will. And he starts using this language of saying, look, I am just doing what my father told me to do. This is kind of apprenticeship language. Remember, in the ancient world, there's not a lot of upward mobility. There aren't job fairs at the high school, okay? Like, you do what your father did at the end. So the idea of a son who is an apprentice to the father and watches carefully what the father has done would be very familiar to everybody he's talking to. And he's taking that cosmically to refer to himself as the son who has watched carefully, and the father is turning over the family business, has given me authority to do these things, right? And then he is bringing witnesses to his defense. The witnesses he gives are John the Baptist, who he says, you know, you listened to for a while, and then you got tired of him. But John has testified to me. My own works have testified to me. What the Father is doing through me is testifying for me. Backing up a little bit. There was an element of the apprenticeship I wanted to hit on, because this is the part where he says, the Father has given me the power to give life, right? That is a strictly divine power. That is not something anybody else is claiming. Part of the Son of God thing that's going on here is that Jesus is claiming this as an individual. There are places in the prophets where it talks about Israel as a whole, all the people are a son of God. There are places where it talks about a king as being a representative of the Son of God, because he is a representative of all of Israel. But Jesus is saying, me, personally, I am a son of God. And that is the blasphemy that they are having problems with. He refers to himself as the Son of Man, which is back to Daniel 7. This is a messianic title. This seems to be Jesus' kind of favorite way of referring to himself as Son of Man. I had a quote from N.T. Wright that I thought was particularly good here. All right. The explanation Jesus gives here, because I am the Son of Man, is why he has the authority, draws from the ancient Jewish picture of the one like a Son of Man in Daniel 7, who is given authority over the world, and particularly to bring God's just judgment to the forces of tyranny and evil that have oppressed God's people. You could put it like this. God has longed to put the world to rights now, and now with his apprentice son on the job, he's doing it at last. But bringing new creation to birth can only be done if the evil that has corrupted the old creation is named, shamed, and dealt with. That's N.T. Wright's for every John for Everyone, which I would heartily recommend that series. It's kind of half commentary, half devotion. It's very good. Anything by N.T. Wright is very good, mostly. So he is saying, God has given me authority to bring life and judgment. And those two things aren't separate. They are related there. The only way to bring life is to bring judgment on all of the things that have been thwarting life, that have been the killers, right? So he brings these witnesses to his defense. And then he turns around on his accusers and says to them, basically, you spend all of your time reading the law of Moses, all of your time, but you haven't understood it at all. And Moses is on my side. Yeah. And so these are fighting words. Okay. This is incendiary language. I don't think this is one of the places where it says, and he slipped away, because they were trying to stone him. But it's to that point where he is being provocative. He is not stepping back from this public role, which again is different in John than the synoptics. In John, it's like he's always on trial throughout most of the gospel, which would have been familiar to John's original audience of persecuted Jewish Christians who are always having to defend themselves, always on trial, about why they're doing what they're doing, and are their beliefs dangerous to the synagogue, are their beliefs dangerous to the Roman Empire. So that constant kind of defensiveness would have been very familiar to John's original audience. This is an interesting kind of take on court language, like prosecutorial language, because in Jewish courts of law, it seems to be that it was more about, like in our courts, you can't just stand up and say, oh yeah, it's not me, it's him. Like that's not part of the way we do our judicial system works. In their court of law, it was about finding what is the truth. And so you could accuse your accusers, but you couldn't only have yourself as the witness. That's the part of his witness speeches is, I've testified about who I am, but in a court of law, which you are putting me on trial now, so in a court of law, Deuteronomy says you have to have more than one witness. So here are my witnesses. John the Baptist is my witness. You know, the Torah is my witness. Yeah. All right. This is the, it's a little thick through this last bit, the discourses. And there's a lot of language that about glory and truth and things like that get thrown around that we're like, oh yeah, we know what that means, I think. So does anybody have any questions about this rather dense discourse section? Or comments? No? Okay, good. Thank you all, by the way, for your comments. That is, I love that. That is my favorite part, is actually having conversations about these things. All right, so. Again, I think that this whole chunk, this whole pericope, the two healings, confrontation with the authorities at the sheep pool is about this question of who is the real giver of life. And the answer Jesus is giving here is Jesus, the Son of God. I am the giver of life. So next week we'll go through the feeding of the 5,000. I'm teaching in next week, and then are you up after that for 7? Or is that
Jeff?
Okay. Well, he's out of town, so he asked me to. Yeah. So.
I'll do it.
Cool. Unless anybody else has any questions, comments, concerns, consternations, I think we're good. All right. Thank you all.